going into Gatlinburg that I've always wanted to stop at, and I just never have, and all the other times that we've been down there. And I said to Becky, I'm like, we're going to stop there this time. So it was the last day we were there, I pulled off the road, and I went to this little antique store there, and I asked the guy, I'm like, do you have any old Bibles in here? And he's like, no, I don't have any old Bibles. And he went to this bookshelf behind the counter, and he pulled off the bookshelf like three rows of books. And all the way in the back, there were three King James Bibles that were like hidden away behind there, right? And this guy, they're up there on the counter, right? They're up there on the coat rack. There's three white ones. They're all colored white. This guy basically insisted that I not leave his store until I took these Bibles off his hands. So he gave them to me. I'm like, well, okay, I'll take them. Maybe I can give them to somebody or whatever. But, like, just a weird. So, you know, we're in the middle of talking about all this history where people wanted the Bible more than anything else, right, in their language. And now the Bible is so prevalent and everywhere, and nobody pays attention to it. And they don't listen to it. They don't pay attention to it. And that story that I just shared with you is just sort of yet another sort of anecdotal evidence of that. But let's get started with the introduction. Last week in Lesson 125, we began looking at the 1557. Sometimes I wonder if I'm a little bit dyslexic. How many of you have ever noticed that when it comes to numbers, I often flip them when I read them out loud? Have any of you noticed that? You have noticed that, huh? I got a lot of problems, okay? But I do that, right? So we're talking about the 1557 Geneva New Testament. So we started looking at that last week in Lesson 125. In doing so, we covered the following topics. So we looked at some further thoughts on the reign of Bloody Mary. We looked at the religious makeup of the Genevan exiles. We discussed possible translators for who's responsible for the 1557 Geneva New Testament. Many believe that it was William Whittingham was the one who was primarily responsible. Remember, we talked about those I statements in the address to the reader. Then we talked about the prefatory information and features. So under that category, I'm just going to scroll up here. We looked at the title page, and we compared the title page to other title pages. And I see this is lagging now and not updating. So let me just try to refresh that and see if that does anything. It's probably not going to. All right, so there goes that part of what I wanted to do. But anyway, we talked about the title page, and we compared the title page for the 1557 Geneva New Testament to other title pages in King James Bibles, or not King James Bibles, previous editions of English Bibles, specifically the Great Bible. We talked about Calvin's introduction, that introduction written by John Calvin that was translated into English from a previous French Bible that showed up in the 1557 Geneva New Testament, and then we looked at the address to the reader. And then we talked about other things related to the text. We talked about the font. We talked about the verse numbers, how this is the first Bible to put verse numbers in, and we discussed that. And then we also talked about the italics, that this is the first English Bible to use italics in the English text when identifying that a word was, that an English word was not necessarily corresponding with a specific Greek word, and to identify English words that are added to the text to complete the thought in English. The Geneva Bible, the Geneva New Testament is the first one to do that. And then we also looked at the book and the chapter headings. So that's kind of what we were looking at last time. So today in Lesson 126, I want to assess the biblical text or readings found in the 1557 Geneva New Testament, and we would do so by comparing it with both William Tyndale and King James. Now, I do want to take a minute here to try to reconnect this, because I do want to show some things here, and it apparently has lost its connection. So I'm going to reset this. So I apologize, but I want to be able to show some things on the screen for the benefit of people who are watching at home. Somebody needs to remind me when this is done that I need to bring in the equipment to make a wired connection so that this doesn't happen. I have the right connector here, but I need a long enough HDMI cable to be able to plug into the TV. I have one at home, I just don't remember to bring it. You know how it is on Sunday morning, right? You're scrambling around trying to figure out, did I remember everything? And then, of course, you inevitably forget something, right? That's, at least that's what happens for me. So I want to put this back up here and try to go from there. So let's look at the first point then, assessing the text. So among historians, there is some disagreement as to which previous English Bible served as the base text for the 1557 Geneva New Testament. Regarding the matter, Dr. Daniel states the following in the Bible in English, its history and influence. He says, quote, "The New Testament text, though aware of Coverdale's work on the Great Bible, goes back behind that to follow Tyndale in 1534. Usually thought to be a version printed in London by Richard Jugg in 1548. Influential for the first time was Theodore Beza's Latin New Testament, published in Geneva the year before in 1556. So what this is saying is that this particular observer of the situation, Dr. David Daniel, he believes that the 1557 Geneva New Testament is fundamentally a revision of William Tyndale's New Testament from 1534, and that served as the base text. Okay, Blackford Condon states the following in the History of the English Bible from 1882. He says, quote, "While the translation of 1557 is based upon the New Testament version of Tyndale as contained in the Matthew's Bible, 1537, yet it is independent and has probably greater claims to originality than any preceding English Bible." So what he's saying there is that he's saying it slightly differently. He's saying that it's Tyndale through the Matthew's Bible of 1537. And then he's saying that there are more original independent readings found in the Geneva New Testament than there were in previous English Bibles. So let's just make sure we understand what that's saying, okay? The first guy to put a Bible into English, to put a Bible into print in English was Tyndale, right? We've seen how Coverdale did his own based upon Latin and German and other things. But then we saw how in 1537, Matthew's Bible moved forward all of Tyndale's translations, and then for the places that Tyndale was not available, it basically just gave Coverdale, right? And then we've seen how in 1539, the Great Bible was a revision of this Bible from 1537. So what Condon is saying is that the Geneva New Testament is based on Tyndale, but there are more things in it that are original that are not necessarily reliant on Tyndale. So let's go to page 2. Meanwhile, J.I. Mombert states it somewhat differently in his 1883 work, English Versions of the Bible. He says, quote, "The Geneva New Testament of 1557 is Tyndale's version collated with the Great Bible, which in the New Testament is likewise based on the version, on that version, and a strong leaning on Beza, with the result of a substantial agreement with Tyndale as less frequent distance from him, an agreement with the Great Bible, and an occasional difference from both, an agreement on Beza." So anyway, what all these guys are talking about is what is forming the base text of this New Testament from 1557. There's no way around that it's William Tyndale, and then to what degree it's other people is debatable. So let's look at my point here. While it is interesting to consider different perspectives on this matter, in the end, it doesn't matter. Okay? In my estimation, in the end, it doesn't matter. Here's why. The bottom line is that the 1557 Geneva New Testament is fundamentally Tyndalean, meaning it doesn't matter if it came through Tyndale, the Matthew's Bible, or the Great Bible. All of those are fundamentally the work of who? Tyndale. So it doesn't really matter from that standpoint, in my opinion. Okay? Whether the base text was the Matthew's Bible of 1537 or the Great Bible of 1539 is of no ultimate consequence, since both of these editions were Tyndalean as well. Once again, we cannot overstate the influence of William Tyndale. His work looms large over all of these pre-1611 English Bibles, as it does with the King James itself. So it's interesting to read what Daniel and Momber and Condit and these guys say about this. It's interesting as sort of an academic understanding of what's going on. But in the end, it doesn't really matter in my estimation, because all of them are fundamentally the work of who? Tyndale, okay? So, next point. As I stated last week in Lesson 125, I have not been able to locate a PDF of a 1557 Geneva New Testament. Therefore, my access to the text has been through Samuel Baxter's 1841 work, The English Hexapla, which presents the 1557 New Testament in its entirety in parallel columns, along with Wycliffe, Tyndale, Cranmer, which is the Great Bible, and Reams, and the Authorized Version. Now, I want to show you what I'm talking about here. So again, the wonders of the Internet allow you access to things. So this document, this is my PDF copy of this document from 1841. This is the English Hexapla by this guy named Baxter. He put this together. So this includes Wycliffe, Tyndale, Cranmer, Geneva, the Reims New Testament, and then the Authorized Version. And it's in parallel columns. So I'm just going to scroll down here quickly and show you what this looks like so that you can get a sense of what I'm talking about. So unfortunately, there's a lot of like extra material here. So let's just go down to where we are. So here we have the text. All right. So up here on this page, you have the Greek. And then underneath it, you have in parallel columns, you have Wycliffe from 1380, you have Tyndale from 1534, and then you have the Great Bible, the Cranmer Bible from 1539, okay? And then on the facing page, you have the Geneva Bible from 1557, the Reims New Testament, and then the Authorized Version, okay? So, I mean, these are like really great finds when you come across this kind of stuff. So my access to and ability to read this Geneva New Testament is coming to me through this document, because I cannot find a standalone PDF copy of this document, but we can access the 1557 text through Baxter's edition here. Okay, so again, I know not everyone like me wants to spend time looking at these things. But when you get into something like this and you compare readings in this kind of way easily, it's extremely fascinating to observe what's going on, okay? We don't have time to look at all that. I just wanted to show you where I'm getting this access to this text from, okay? So let's look at the next point on page 2, middle of the page. There's disagreement over the wisdom of Baxter's choice to include the Geneva text from 1557 instead of the one from 1560 in his English Hexapla. Mombert states the following regarding the matter, quote, "Before giving a few extracts from this first Geneva New Testament of 1557, I cannot but deplore the mistaken judgment of the reproduction of the text of that edition in Baxter's Hexapla in lieu of that of 1560. First, because the latter, on account of its intrinsic superiority, possesses a critical value in which the first is deficient, and secondly, because the critical importance which the version of 1557 does possess is derived from the annotations which Baxter's reprint are omitted." So what is he saying here, okay? What Mombert is saying here is, the guy who put this together should not have used this 1557 New Testament. He should have used the complete Geneva Bible from 1560, because that represents the Genevan tradition, if you will, in its most complete form. Is everybody following that? And second, he's saying any value that was here in this 1557 from a critical standpoint is lost because he doesn't have the marginal notes. And those things are taken out of here. All he's giving you is the text. So that's one opinion of this, okay? Let me just say to you, for me to find this and be able to read it, I was thrilled to death, regardless of what Mombert said, because I could actually read it for myself. Look at the next point. So according to Mombert, Baxter should have used the 1557 text instead of the 1557 text in his work. In Mombert's view, only the marginal, should say notations, we need to change that to notations, only the marginal notations of the 1557 text are of, quote, critical importance, and they do not appear on Baxter's Hexapla. I think that should say in Baxter's Hexapla. Professor Daniel offers a much different perspective. He says, quote, Baxter's choice of this text, referring to the 1557, over the New Testament from the complete 1560 Geneva, that should say Bible, has been regarded as odd, but his decision was sound. For so much that was later standard, not only in the King James, for example, first appeared in 1557. So what's he saying? He's saying there are King James readings that show up in the King James Bible that first appeared in English in this 1557 New Testament. So Daniel thinks that Baxter made the right decision by including this one over the other one. So you have some scholarly disagreement there about it. So let me just tell you again from my point of view. I have in my library, I brought it in last week, a 1560 Geneva New Testament. If it weren't for this document and this edition from Baxter here, I wouldn't have access to this, the text of 1557, so I'm kind of happy that he did it this way. Is everybody following this? So while I understand Mombert's point, I side with Daniel in this discussion. My interests lie in trying to ascertain when a given English reading first appeared in the English Bible. Baxter's use of the 1557 grants us access to this text, which might otherwise have been hidden from view. So everybody clear on why I'm saying that? The following, so I'm going to switch this back over to the notes, if I can get it to cooperate. And we need page 3. Okay. The following examples were selected to give us a flavor of how the Genevan text compares with the text of William Tyndale and the King James Bible. Adopting a standard format for doing this was a bit tricky since each used a slightly different methodology. So let's change that, Sylvia, since each author used a slightly different methodology. The first grouping of examples are taken from the works of Dr. David Daniel and Blackford Condon. And the tables that follow, underlined words, indicate wording changes from the preceding translation listed in the table. Okay, so let me just show you what I'm talking about there before we look specifically, all right? So here's the Lord's Prayer from Matthew 6. Here's Tyndale from 1534, and then here's the Geneva New Testament. So underlines indicate wording changes from Tyndale. Underlines in the King James text would indicate wording changes from what? The Geneva, from the center column. So that's just explaining how I did this. Okay? Let's go back to the notes. So in the tables that follow, underlined words indicate wording changes from the preceding translation listed in the table. Please also note that I have updated the spelling of words wherever possible for increased readability. So I didn't change any words. I just updated how they were spelled so that you could actually read it. Okay? Now, before we go any further, let me say, I spent a long time trying to catch every word change. And eventually I went cross-eyed. So there's probably some in here that I've overlooked. If you encounter one, please point it out so that I can fix it in this. But when you're looking at this many verses line by line, comparing them line by line, is eventually you start seeing double, and I'm sure I've missed a couple. So if you find one, underline it on your sheet and let me know, okay? So let's look at these. So the first one is from the Lord's Prayer, Matthew 6, all right? Now, the first thing that I want to point out to you is a formatting issue, all right? Remember, Tyndale had no verse numbers. There were no verse numbers in Tyndale. So I left it like that with no verse numbers. The first Bible to introduce the use of verse numbers is the Geneva what? New Testament. So I've presented it to you exactly the way that it appeared in that particular edition. And then obviously this would be the King James text, right? So as you work your way through this and you try to conduct this type of, you know, sort of comparative study or collation, it does get a little bit frustrating. So let's just kind of go here line by line. So this is the Lord's Prayer, right? So Tyndale said, "Our Father which art in heaven, hallowed be thy name." Geneva, "Our Father which art in heaven, hallowed be thy name." Notice, is the punctuation different? Yes, there's a comma in the Geneva Bible after heaven. There was not in Tyndale. All right? King James, "Our Father which art in heaven, hallowed be thy name." So for verse 9, is the King James exactly identical to the Geneva? Even in punctuation? Yes. Is the text reading identical with Tyndale? Yes. So when I'm talking here about Tyndalean influence, since 1534, the wording of that verse never what? Changed in an English Bible. You following that? Okay. So the next bit. So this would be verse 10. Let thy kingdom come, thy will be fulfilled, Tyndale said, as well in earth as it is in heaven. Okay? Geneva. Let thy kingdom come, so that's the same. Thy will be done, even in earth as it is where? In heaven. So notice here we have a different wording. Is it saying the same thing? Is the substance of it the same?
Yes.
It's just a different wording, right? Then you come to King James. Verse 10, thy kingdom come, thy will be done. So here we have a slightly different punctuation. You have a comma here that you didn't have in the Geneva. I didn't underline punctuation. Maybe I should have, but I didn't. I just underlined in wording, okay? Now notice this. This is what you're familiar with, right? In earth as it is where? In heaven. So this is slightly worded different. The King James is slightly worded different from the Geneva, which is slightly worded different from who? Tyndale. But is the substance the same? Are they substantively communicating the same thing? Absolutely they are. Okay? Verse 11. So Tyndale, remember, he's not marking it. Give us this day our daily bread. Geneva. Give us this day our daily bread, period. King James, give us this day our daily bread. Is it exactly the same as what Tyndale had in 1534? Yes. Go to verse 12. And forgive us our trespasses, even as we forgive our trespassers. That's what Tyndale had. Geneva, and forgive us our debts. So debt... trespasses now is what? Debts. Even as we forgive our debtors. So that's the only change, and this comma here. Okay? Is everybody tracking with me here? That's the kind of tedious work you got to do to understand this stuff. All right? And maybe some of you are like, boy, I wish you'd just move along. But I want you to see. I've been trying to build and make an argument here now for a very long number of weeks about how the King James is fundamentally what? Tyndale. Okay? Now go to the King James. Verse 12. And forgive us our debts as we forgive our debtors. Is the King James reading in verse 12 exactly identical to the Geneva New Testament in that verse? Yes. Tyndale, Geneva, and King James, are they substantively saying the same thing?
Yep.
Let's go to verse 13, which starts... So Tyndale had, "And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. For thine is the kingdom and the power and the glory forever. Amen." Geneva, Of course, it decides to bug out on me right when I want to read it. Forgive us, Geneva, and lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. For thine is the kingdom and the power and the glory forever. Amen. Is it exactly identical to Tyndale? King James, and lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. For thine is the kingdom and the power and the glory forever. Amen. That verse, verse 13, so verse 9, verse 11, verse 13, never changed. Going all the way back to Tyndale from 1534. Is everybody following that? Okay, so let's just... Anybody have any questions or comments about that, or anything stand out to you when you actually take time to look at this stuff?
I have kind of a question. My grandma always prayed trespassers and trespassers, and she would have learned in the very early 1900s. Do you think that tradition passed down to her?
Well, do you know, did she grow up reading a King James Bible or like the Revised Version or something else?
I don't know what they had.
Yeah, I don't know either. I mean, I've heard people even say swap out debts for trespasses. I've heard people pray it that way. So that could be tradition. That could be related to maybe the way the Common Book of Prayer had it. There could be a number of explanations for why somebody would have memorized it that way. Any other thoughts or observations here? Do you see how important Tyndale was? So when I say to you that the King James Bible was 83% Tyndale, that's not a made-up thing. It is 83% what? But think about it. Yes, this is 83% Tyndale, but is this 83% Tyndale too? Yeah, because this is coming from who? Tyndale. Is everybody following that? Let's go to the next one, at Luke 15. Luke 15. So, again, I just want to point out, no verse numbers in Tyndale. Geneva, I included the verse numbers. Here, I added a space. I added a space here just so that these verses would line up nicely for you to make the comparison. Okay? So let's start here. Verse 8. Tyndale said, either what woman want, having 10 groats, if she lose one, doth not light a candle and sweep the house and seek diligently till she find it. Alright? Now, here we go now to the Geneva. Either what woman having 10 pieces of what? Silver. So 10 groats is changed to what? So groats, what do you suppose you'd find out if you looked up the word groats?
It's a silver coin.
It's a silver coin. It's a piece of money, right? So here the Geneva says 10 pieces of silver. Other than that, is the verse the same? Yep. Let's go to verse 9. And when she hath found it, she called her lovers and her neighbors, saying, rejoice with me, for I have found the groat which I had lost. Now, when we read this about she called her lovers, you think something very different with that word in the 21st century than that word meant here. Here, in the middle of the 16th century, that was another word for what? Friends. Now if we talk about a woman having multiple lovers, we're talking about something nefarious and, you know, that kind of thing, right? But not so here. But notice, so let's look at the Geneva New Testament. And when she hath found it, she calleth her friends and her neighbors. So lovers is switched to what? Friends. And her neighbors, saying, rejoice with me, for I have found the peace which I have lost. So there's a change there from groat to what? Peace. So I forgot to do this, so let's do this for 9 and 10. Let's go to King James. Either what woman hath 10 pieces of silver, if she lose one piece, so the word peace is here, it's not in the Geneva, doth not light a candle and sweep the house and seek diligently till she find it. Verse 9, and when she hath found it, she calleth her friends and her neighbors, they add the word what? Together, saying, rejoice with me, for I have found the peace which I have lost. So a couple things I want to point out there. Again, is there any substantive difference in meaning between Tyndale, the Geneva New Testament, and the King James Bible? No substantive difference in meaning, right? But we see the development of the text over time, and again, is what we end up with in the King James and the Geneva still fundamentally Tyndalean? Look at the last verse in this example, verse 10. So, Tyndale said, "Likewise I say unto you, joy is made in the presence of the angels of God when one sinner, over one sinner that repenteth." Geneva. "Likewise I say to you, joy is made in the presence of..." Now I did do this. I'm pointing out here that they started capitalizing words like angels. Tyndale didn't have that what? That wasn't capitalized there, okay? "Angels of God over one sinner, that converteth," is what the Geneva had. But now look at King James. "Likewise I say unto you, there is joy in the presence of the angels of God over one sinner that what? Repenteth." So the King James switches it back to what?
Tyndale.
To Tyndale. You guys need to understand that what we're doing here, I have never seen. Maybe it's out there and I just haven't seen it, because I will admittedly tell you I haven't seen everything, okay? But I have never seen any King James Bible believer advocate break things down the way that I'm trying to break them down for you here. Because what I want for us to do, and for anybody watching this at home, is to really understand what is going on here. And the process and the progression that we're going through in the English Bible during these times that we're studying. Okay? So let's look at the next part there. Regarding the comparison between Tyndale and the Geneva New Testament, Dr. Daniel states the following. And I think I've more than adequately pointed this out to you already. But the dependence on Tyndale is clear. But so are the changes from 10 groats to 10 pieces of silver, from her lovers to her friends. The older lovers did not have the sexual sense in Tyndale, as I already said. Though the Rheims New Testament of 1582, on which it has so often been said that the King James revisers heavily relied, restored groats, King James itself gave pieces of silver from 1557. King James followed Tyndale's "sinner that repenteth" rather than the 1557's "a sinner that converteth," strikingly not taking the Rheims' "sinner that doeth penance." And I'm glad they didn't say that. So let's just talk about that. That's total. If you say "one sinner that repenteth" or "one sinner that converteth," is that substantively equivalent?
Yes.
But if you say "sinner that doeth penance," is that a substantive difference in meaning?
Absolutely.
Big time. Okay? So again, people that are watching this and listening to this, what I'm saying is there latitude in the English Bible for different ways of saying the same thing? Yes. What I am still against adamantly is the idea of a substantive difference in what? In meaning. You can say "one sinner that repenteth," or you can say "one sinner that converteth," six of one, half a dozen of another, but you can't say "one sinner that doeth penance." Because that's now a whole different what? That's a whole different thing. All right? So before we move on, any questions or comments about any of that? No? All right. Luke 18, verses 1 through 5. So let's just kind of go through here. I think we can kind of, well, there are a few here that we definitely need to point out. So let's look at verse 1 in Tyndale. So I'm right here. "And he put forth a similitude unto them, signifying that men ought always to pray and not to be weary saying." Okay? There was a certain judge in a city. So I already went too far. The verse ends with saying, I believe. Now let's just look at this. So let's look at the Geneva New Testament here. All right? Notice that we see some very important things that we need to identify. And he put forth a similitude also unto them. Now watch. To this end is in what? Italics. Tyndale had, and he put forth this similitude unto them, and he didn't have what? To this end. So here we see for the first time in an English Bible, I'm not saying this is the first occurrence of this, because I'm sure it's not. We're in Luke here. I'm sure there were more before this. When I say the first time in an English Bible, I mean the first time an English Bible did this. You see the use of the italics and how the italics helps explain and helps understand in English what the text is saying in Greek. You following that? Okay? That they ought always to pray and not wax faint. Where Tyndale had, ought always to pray and not to be weary saying. So there's a few differences here. The biggest one, though, is the use of this what? Italics. So let's go to the King James for verse 1. And he spake. So these said put forth. And the King James uses the word what? Spake. And he spake a what? Parable, whereas the Geneva New Testament and Tyndale both had what? Similitude. Well, what is a parable? It's a similitude, right? It's a story designed to teach a lesson or what have you, right? So here we see parable in the King James where Tyndale had similitude, as did the Geneva Bible. Okay? And then we also have Tyndale had men. That's dropped out in the Geneva and added back in for the King James. You see, Tyndale says that men ought, or the King James says that men ought always to pray and not faint, signifying that men ought always to pray and not be weary saying. So Tyndale had men. They took it out in the Geneva and they put it back in where? In the King James. All right? Let's go to verse 2. Saying. So verse 2 starts with saying. You see, again, I just want to point something out here. You see how the verse numbers help you understand what verse is being talked about? I mean, I know a lot of people don't like them, and I understand their arguments. I'm not saying I agree with them, but I understand what they're saying. But imagine you're in church, and this is all everybody has. How am I going to preach effectively to the congregation without telling everybody what verse I'm reading at? Take a lot longer, right? And by the time I'm done, you folks are just finding it. And I think this illustration in particular here really makes that clear. Now notice, so verse 2 starts with the word saying. See? Saying, saying. Now notice, so it's capitalized here, it wasn't there, because here there's a colon or a semicolon? It's a colon. And here there's a period, and here there's a comma. So you got a comma here at the end of verse 1, here you got a period at the end of verse 1, there you got a colon. So again, I kind of touched on this last week. What? I agree. One of the things that's happening throughout this period is not only is the language developing in terms of the words, but is English punctuation refining itself. And that continues after the King James. So let me say that differently. What I mean to say there is this. When the 1611 King James came out, the one that you guys read from is a 1769 copy edition. Did the punctuation change between 1611 and 1769. Yes. So we just have to understand these things because of the way punctuation rules. I mean, I'll tell you one of the worst things about writing books is the stupid punctuation. You know, I put a comma and somebody comes along and says, that should be a semicolon, or that should be this, or that should, right? I mean, you get 10 English professors in a room and ask them to punctuate a paragraph and you're going to get 12 different, you know, and because some of it is just preference. All right, but what I'm pointing out there is this: not only is the language itself and the words in the process of changing, but is the punctuation also. Okay. So here Tyndale said weary. Here they said wax faint. Here they just said not what. They took the word wax out. Verse 2. Again, it's capitalized. Notice that the word judge is what? Capitalized. The King James is doing that still. Now, today, we wouldn't do that. Unless we're talking about a specific what?
Judge.
If we're talking about a specific judge, then we would what? Then we use a cap, right? But that's not the way we do things, at least the way most people in English. So let's go through this, verse 2. So it starts here, saying, There was a judge in a certain city which feared not God, neither regarded man. Period. Verse 2 in Geneva, saying, there was a judge in a certain city which feared not God, neither what? So the change is from regarded to what? Reverence. Okay, King James. Saying, there was in a city, a judge, so different word order, took out certain, different word order. They took out the word certain, but are they still talking about a city? So there was in a city a judge which feared not God, neither regarded man. So again, we see the change from reverence back to what?
Regarded.
Verse 3. There was a certain widow in the same city which came unto him saying, avenge me of mine adversary. Geneva. And there was a certain widow in the same city which came unto him saying, do me justice against mine adversary. Here it was what? Avenge me of mine adversary. Here it was do me justice, right? Now look at King James. And there was a widow in that city, and she came unto him saying, avenge me of mine what? Adversary. So again, the King James, and notice how it's capitalized also, the King James is moving back to what? To Tyndale again. All right? Verse 4, and he would not for a while, but afterward he said unto himself, though I fear not God nor care for man, so I think I've already gone too far, haven't I? And he would not for a while, but afterward he said unto himself, though I fear not God nor care for man, yet because this widow troubleth me, I will avenge her, lest at the last she come and hag on me. Okay? So, that's technically verses 4 and 5. But look at it again. And he would not for a what?
Long time.
Long time is now in what?
Italics.
Here it said, and he would not for a what?
While.
Okay, he would not for a long time. But afterward he said with himself, so he's having this conversation with himself, though I fear not God nor what?
Reverence
man. Here he said, but after he said to himself, though I fear not God nor care for who? Man, yet because this widow troubleth me, I will do her right, lest at the last she come and make me weary with her importunity. I don't know if that's much better than hag on me, but Okay? Verse 4. And he would not for a while. King James. Notice what's missing. The italics. The King James opted not to use the italics, and they go back more in line with who?
Tyndale.
And he would not for a what? For a while. All right? But he would not for a while, but afterward he said within himself, though I fear not God nor regard man, yet because this widow troubleth me, I will avenge her. It's a different word here. Here it was do her what? Right. What did Tyndale have?
Avenge her.
I will avenge her, lest by her continually coming she weary me. I like that a lot better than hag on me or and make me weary with her importunity. Okay? So, I'm not going through this just to tax your patience. I hope you're getting and observing some really important things here about what's going on. So let's look at the quote underneath that on page 4. Dr. Daniel offers the following analysis of Luke 18, verses 1 through 5. That's what we just went through. He says, quote, KJV kept the first italics to this end, but not the others. I think we need to have that in italics there. Sylvia, what says to this end? But not the others. Going back to Tyndale's a while. Tyndale's hag did not survive, though it is recorded in the OED to fatigue, tire out. The importunity of 1557 gave the parable its title, the Importune Widow. To me, one of the biggest ones here, though, in this example, is the use of the word what? Parable instead of similitude. Okay? All right, so we got time for one more. And this is a really familiar one. Let me just make sure. So let's end this lesson by looking at 1 Corinthians 13. All right? 1 Corinthians 13. So again, Tyndale's got no verse numbers. Though I speak with the tongues of men and of angels and have not love, I am become as sounding, I'm immediately defaulting back to this, but though I speak with the tongues of men and of angels, and yet had no love, I were even as sounding brass or as a tinkling cymbal. Geneva. Only change is the I am here. Did I miss one? Speak. Although, can you flag this for me to check that on the Geneva?
Mm-hmm.
Not sure. That might have been my mistake. You see why this is hard? I mean, you're comparing all the stuff, and eventually you're going to miss stuff, right? King James. Though I speak with the tongues of men and of angels and have not charity, I am become as a sounding brass or a tinkling cymbal. So here we have the word become, but notice this change. Every version before the bishops had love in this passage every time, and not charity. Okay? Every time you see charity in this passage, Tyndale, Geneva, Coverdale, Great Bible, the Bishop's Bible moves it from love to charity, and then the King James follows the bishops when they use charity. But right now, we're just comparing these three, and charity is a difference from what? From love. Tyndale?
Yeah.
I have no idea. Maybe there's an answer that I just don't know about, but if you're asking me to give you one right now, I don't know the answer to it. All right? Sorry. Verse 2. And though I could prophesy and understood all secrets and all knowledge, yea, if I had all faith so that I could move mountains out of their places, and yet had no love, I were nothing. That's what Tyndale had. Geneva, and though I could prophesy and understand all secrets and all knowledge, yea, if I had all faith so that I could move mountains out of their places, and yet had not love, I were what? Basically identical to what Tyndale had. Now look at the King James in the far column. And though I have the gift of prophecy and understand all mysteries, so secrets has changed to what? Mysteries. And all knowledge, and though I have all faith so that I could remove mountains and have no charity, I am what? Nothing. So you can see there the types of changes that are being made. So this is really long. Let's just go to page 5. Let's just look at some of the more significant changes, just for the sake of time. You have a significant change in verse 5. Disdaineth not as unbeseeming in the Geneva. King James has, doth not behave itself unseemly. So, obviously, which one is more fluent? The King James is definitely much more fluent. Now, and I'm going to make this point again. Can anybody point out to me where verse 5 starts in Tyndale? You got to like look at it for 20 minutes just to figure out where verse 5 would what? Where it would start. All right? And I'm asking you because I can't, it's not readily apparent to me either, and I've looked at it for a whole week. All right? Look at verse 8. Look at verse 8. Geneva. Love doth never fall away, though that both prophecies shall be abolished and tongues shall cease and learning shall vanish away. Versus the King James, charity never faileth, but whether there be prophecies, they shall fail. Whether there be tongues, they shall cease. Whether there be knowledge, it shall what? Vanish away. And I want to point something else out. Look at how they're spelling the word be. Two E's. That's the way it was spelled in the 1611. And charity is different here than it was further up, right? Now, that might be my fault because I might have missed that one as far as updating the spelling. So we'd have to check that, Amy, to know for sure. But definitely you see some things. I've got examples at home, guys, of Genesis chapter 1 in the creation account where the King James spells the word be, B-E-E in one verse, and in the very next verse it spells it B-E. So there's a spelling variant within the text, literally within verses of each other. Okay? Let's go down and look at verse 12. Verse 12. I want to point out the Geneva. For now we see in a glass and in a dark speaking, but then shall we see face to face. Now I know in part, but then shall I know even as I am known. Versus the King James, for now we see through a glass darkly, but then face to face. Now I know in part, but then shall I know even as I am known. Tyndale had, if I could find it, he had, now we see in a glass, even in a dark speaking, but then shall we see face to face. So you can see there's a lot of changes that have happened in that verse over time. And then finally, verse 13, the last verse, now abideth faith, hope, and love, even these three. So I'm reading the Geneva. But now abideth faith, hope, and love, even these three. But the chiefest of these is love. Go back and look at Tyndall. Let's go back and look at Tyndall. Now, Tyndall said, now abideth faith, hope, and love, even these three, but the chiefest of these is what? So that's exactly the same between Tyndall and the Geneva of 1557. And then the King James says, and now abideth faith, hope, charity, these three, but the greatest of these is what?
Charity.
So definitely, so they switch chiefest to what? Greatest, and they switch again love to what?
Charity.
All right? So if you look at page, if you look bottom of page 5, textual examples, okay? So if you just kind of leaf through the rest of this, what we're going to do is we're going to stop at the bottom of page 5, and then next Sunday, and this is actually good timing for me because it's a holiday week and I didn't know how much time I was going to have to put a lesson together for next week. So if we stop here, then I already have a lesson done for next week. Okay, now, look, listen, before we quit, I hope this isn't boring to you. Okay? I hope this isn't something that you're like, man, I wish you'd just get on with it. You need to see with your own eyes what is happening to the English Bible as we work our way through time. Okay? To me, this is all very enlightening and very fascinating, and I wish that more folks would take the time to look at these things that we're covering here. All right? Any questions or comments before we go?
Did you say you were going to be talking about what the differences between love and charity and how they're divided into?
I already did that.
Okay.
In the Sunday morning service when we got to 1 Corinthians 13.
Okay.
I did two studies on it. I think I titled it something, Love or Charity, What's the Difference?
Okay.
Or something like that. If you want me to, I could send you those links. But like this is, so did Tyndall get it wrong when he said love?
No.
Was he making a doctrinal error when he said love over charity? But you understand there are a lot of King James Bible believers that will say if it doesn't say charity, it's a mistake and you need to get a different Bible.
That's what I used to do with a friend of mine in the past. We were looking up those words. That's what we had that understanding for a bit.
But if you look up the word charity in the Oxford English Dictionary, guess what the first definition of charity is?
Love.
Tyndall had love. Coverdale had love. Matthews had love. The Great Bible had love. The Geneva Bible had love. All of them had love until you got to the bishops, which only in like 26 places switched it from love to charity. Every other time it kept charity, it kept love. So yes, I talk about all of that in those two studies. And look, there are people that will get mad at me for going back and looking at this kind of data in informing how I understand that. Because they think that God somehow divinely imparted the word charity to the translators in between 1604 and 1611. And go ahead, Blake.
No, that was my old understanding, was that God was basically the same thing was helping them pen the King James, is my old understanding of it.
So if I'm an Acts 2 Baptist person, like Gail Ripplinger, like Peter Ruckman, like the vast majority of defenders of the King James have been, I have no problem saying stuff like that. But if I'm a mid-Acts Pauline dispensationalist who believes that Paul is my apostle, and I believe that revelation and inspiration ceased when the Word of God was complete, because of what I believe about the spiritual gifts, I cannot say now that between 1604 and 1611, God did some extra, special, divine work in English because it's inconsistent with what I say I believe about these other things. And this apparently seems to be, you know, a hard concept for some people to get. But I guess it is what it is in that regard. But we definitely have to quit. It's a good question. Remind me to send you those links, though. All right, we're going to resume next Sunday at the top of page 6.